This Agadah, which is on page 1, I reproduced it again so we have it in front of us. We already went through this Agadah, which is, again, sort of an anthemic Agadah of Chazal talking about themselves and about the process. And about what I suggested was this is really at the intersection between a prophetic tradition and a debated legislative process, which is what Halakha has become ever since. And Chazal are telling us the story about that meeting. What's interesting about it is that story is often taught and told on, as it is on page 1, out of context. So last week when I introduced the whole literature of Agadah, I mentioned that one of the critical differences between Agadah in the Midrash collections and Agadah in Talmud Bavli is Agadah in the Midrash collections is really driven by text, meaning you read Bereshit Rabbah at the beginning, there's Agadot about creation, and later on Agadot about Cain and Hevel, and later Agadot about Avraham. And you're looking for, let's say, for the famous Agadah about Avraham and the baseball bat, you'll find it at the very end of Noach. Or Agadot about the Ekedah, you'll find it at the end of Vayera. And it kind of follows in order. But thematically, it's not necessarily united. It's driven by the Psukim. Agadah in Talmud Bavli, which is what we're looking at, is really driven by theme. But remember that Talmud Bavli is not a book of Agadah, it's a book of Halakha. So what's the theme? So what often happens is there will be a halachic discussion about something, and then there'll be, usually at the end of it, some sort of an agadic observation, exhortation, conclusion or something about the way someone should behave, or the metaphysical impact of mitzvot, or whatever it might be. And then that will spin off into a whole long agadic discussion about things related to it, which sometimes the only connection between the items is that it's the same Baal Agadah, or it's interpreting the same series of psukim, or something of that sort. So for instance, in Daf Yomi, we just completed the 8th parak of Masachet Bava Batra, which is focused on Yerusha, and there's a critical Mishnah in there about Benot Slavchad, because the whole rule of Benot Slavchad is what really initiated and provoked the laws of Yerusha. And as a result, there's agadot about Benot Slavchad and how old they were, and they were tzitkaniyot, and etc. All the midrashim we're familiar with from Perush Rashi and Chumash, many of them come from there. So you're looking at this very famous story, which again may be the most famous agadah in Talmud Bavli, which is Rabbi Eliezer and Tanur Shel Achnai, and say, okay, that's a very nice story. Step back and say, and you see on top of the page it says Bava Metzia. So what's this doing in Bava Metzia? You know, Bava Metzia is about contracts, Bava Metzia is about Avedot. Right? What does that have to do with this? So that's why you have to roll backwards and see the larger context and actually find out that this story is about something very different than you thought. If you remember, a couple of years ago, we studied Kamsa Bar Kamsa. And if you ask somebody on the street, what's Kamsa Bar Kamsa about? Then their answer will be Sinat Chinam. Right? And if you ask them, and the funny thing is, if you ask them, what was the problem? They say, well, Kamsa and Bar Kamsa hated each other. And then you say, well, actually, Kamsa doesn't do anything in the story. It's some unknown guy, but it's really not about that. It's about a whole different thing, but you got to see the story broader and check the parallel stories. See, it's really about a failure of rabbinic leadership. That's the Kamsa Bar Kamsa. So you have to see things in the broader context. The Mishnah in Bava Metzia, in the fourth parak, the fourth parak is devoted to a lotaseh in the Torah, which is the lotaseh of ona'ah. Ona'ah means price gouging. Right? But ona'ah evidently carries another layer of meaning, which is to really make somebody crestfallen. I don't know a better way to say it. To make somebody feel just really bad. And the notion is that we all know that when we have been misled to our disadvantage, we feel bad. In Hebrew, we have the word friar. The last thing you want to be is a friar, right? Everybody else paid $10 for it. You paid $15. Friar. The fact that it's really cost $15 and everybody benefited from the mistake doesn't matter. I'm a friar, right? So there's this notion of ona'ah. And then the last mission, the fourth parak, says, Keshem sheyesh ona'ah b'mamon kach yesh ona'ah b'dvarim. So there's not only ona'ah with money, there's ona'ah with words. And they give one example, which is to go window shopping, meaning to start discussing price, and you have no intent of buying. Because what are you doing? You're making the shopkeeper get his hopes up that he's going to sell something, and you have no intent. Or to say to, and these are two famous examples, to say to a Baal Tshuva, remember how you used to behave? or to say to a ger, remember how your parents used to behave? Right? And so those examples of onat dvarim. And that spins off into the sugya, but we're now going to see the broader sugya. We'll skip the middle part because we already did it, but just to point it out. So the agadic section of this really starts very much on point. Amar avchina b'reid ravidi. And this is really kind of anchoring the whole notion of onat dvarim. Because the Torah never says the words onat dvarim, obviously, and never says the words al tonu ishat ager or something like that. Not exactly. So, lo tonu ishat amito. Im shitcha b'torah mitzvot al tonu. So the first thing is, this is a general rule, and a lot of these interpersonal mitzvot is they apply within the community of the committed. So Amar Rav, le'olam yehe adam zahir ba'onat ishto. Now this is very much related. A person has to be very careful to not make your wife feel bad. All right? Why? Shemitoch shedim'ata mitzuya ona'ata krova. Now what does that mean? Dim'ata mitzuya means she cries more easily. As a result of that, ona'a comes quicker. So ona'a seems to be sort of the result of the obvious reaction that you caused in somebody. Certain people you can insult them, it's like milk off a duck's back, they don't care. And some people, the minute you say something, they start getting very upset and shaking. So you have to be more careful about the ona'a there. Amra Rabbi Elazar, miyom shenechrav beit hamikdash nin alu sha'arei tefila. Right? So the notion that when you pray to Hashem, Hashem is listening, we have this very upsetting idea that with the Churban Beit HaMikdash, the gates of tefillah were locked. Right? Shenemar gam ki azag v'shaveh satam tefillati. I cry out, and God closes off my tefillah. V'af li shesharei tefillah ninalu, sharei dma'ot lo ninalu. But here's the upshot. Even though the gates of prayer were locked, the gates of tears are not locked. What does that mean? It seems to mean that a well-formulated prayer beforehand was accepted, and now God's not listening. But somebody just cries out with a pure weeping that those gates are not locked. Right? Shenemar shimat tfilati Adonai v'shavati hazina el dimati altecherash. Now, this is a pasuk in Tehillim. And Tehillim is composed, we presume, at a time the Beit HaMikdash is operating. So how does this help us? The answer is look at the order in the pasuk. Hear my tefillah, Hashem, and listen to my cry, and do not turn a deaf ear to my tears. So it's as if saying, hear my tefillah, hear my cry. You're not going to listen to that? At least, don't turn a deaf ear to my ear, to my tears. So the tears seem to have a last resort kind of power. The Amar Rav, now this seems to come out of nowhere, and you cannot argue that they decided to put all the statements of Rav into one place, because that would take several mesechtot. Kol ha'olech ba'atzat ishto nofel b'gehinom. And anybody who follows the advice of his wife ends up in a very bad place. Shemrak lo ke achav. This is when Achav dies. Okay. When Achav, at the end of his career, we say there was nobody as bad as Achav, and the reason was because he married Izebel, and he followed Izebel, Asher hisata ishto, that's the Vigomer, etc. Papa labaye. Right? So if your wife's leaning over, you should lean over with her and talk with her. So it depends. If we're talking about regular business stuff, fine. If we're talking about heavenly things, then you got to lead the way. So it could be the reverse of that. Right? Amar Rav Chisda, but by the way, this whole thing about the wife, where did this come in? We're talking about how powerful tears are. And then we mentioned, have to be careful not to make your wife feel bad because her tears will come more easily, and therefore the ona'a comes quicker, okay. But this whole thing about the wife is like coming out of nowhere, it seems. Amar Rav Chisda. In other words, you have a kind of question on the editor. The editor is putting together all sorts of statements of early Amoraim, Rav and Rav Chista and Rav Elazar, and what is tying them together? Kol ha-sha'arim nin'alim chutz mi-sha'arei ona'a. All the gates to heaven are closed except for the gates of ona'a, meaning somebody who is the victim of ona'a cries out, those gates are open. Shemar hinei Adonai nitzav ha-chomot anach, this nivuah in Sefer Amos and Perek Zion, when I see God standing on a wall, now Chumat Tanach may mean a wall that has a level on it. It's been measured out exactly, but it seems to be a wall sort of judgment. And he's holding the judgment in his hands. It sounds like no matter what happens, if somebody's been mistreated in that way, then God pays attention to it. Now here's another piece. God will always use an agent, whatever that may mean, to exact punishment for somebody who did wrong, except if they did wrong in Ona'ah, and then it's God himself. Right? Shneimar, and again, the same pasuk, Uviyado Anach. God is holding this measure in his hand. Okay? I'm Rabbi Avau. Shlosha eina pragod ninal bifneihem. So kind of parallel in the same idea, there are three to whom the gates to heaven, the barrier to heaven, is not locked. Ona'a nigzal v'avodah zarah. Somebody's the victim of theft.
What?
V'gezel, sorry. V'avodah zarah. Somebody's the victim of theft, or in Bnei Yisrael do avodah zarah. So that comes through. Ona'a dikli v'ado anach, etc. It's like so bizarre. We're talking about Ona'a, we're talking about the gates of heaven, we're talking about things that pierce through the locked gates of heaven, and then it keeps getting interspersed with these things about how you treat your wife. Now the first one I got because it's about Ona'a, and you got to be very careful because it'll be easy, the tears will come quicker, so you got to be more careful. Well, we all understand that. But what's this? Why do you have good things in your house? You have good things in your house. You have God's blessing in your house because of your wife. That's in Egypt. Avram became rich because of Sarai. Rava said to the people of his town, be careful to honor your wife and you'll become rich. Right? So, a nice little connection. But again, this sugya seems to be like a rat in a maze. They're going here, didn't work, go there, didn't work, go back there, didn't work. Ona'a, ishto, tama'ot, tefillah, kvod ishto, osher, all over the place. And again, there's nothing tying it together. It's not even all Rav. So it's not as if like we have 10 statements of Rav we put together. There seems to be kind of a theme problem. And then, as if we're not confused enough, Tananatam, we have a Mishnah out of Masechet Kelim, Tumah v'Tahara, Chatcho Chuliyot v'Natan Chol Ben Chuliyah l'Chuliyah, Rabbi Eliezer Metar v'Chachamim Metamin, Zeh Otan Rosh Halachnai. That's the Mishnah. So this just says, if you have a ceramic oven, and you cut it into joints, and you put sand in between each joint, and put it back together, meaning it was Tameh, you take it apart and put sand in between each joint and put it back together. Rabbi Eliezer says it's tahor because essentially you've made a new thing. And Chachamim say it's tameh, meaning it holds its old tumah. And that's called the Tanur Rosh Halachnai. Now Achnai may be the name of the guy who made it. It might be a registered trademark. But Achnai in Aramaic conveniently also means snake. And so the Gemara then says, why is it called Tanur Rosh Halachnai? Because the Chachamim surrounded Rabbi Eliezer with their arguments like a snake, kind of like a python. And then from there goes the whole famous story that we studied last week. But the story doesn't end where everybody ends it. Whenever this story is taught publicly, taught at a introduction to Talmud class for the Federation, which is beautiful, it's beautiful things. It all ends with four words, Nitzchuni Banai, Nitzchuni Banai. Right, the famous thing with Rabbi Eliezer. So let's go to there and see that it doesn't end there. Amru, if you see, it's about two-thirds of the way down. Amru oto ayom hiviu kol tarot shdir Rabbi Eliezer usrafum ba'esh. So the story up until now is interesting. It's miraculous. It challenges how we interpret it, because either we take it literally and then we're challenged with all sorts of miraculous behavior, or it's symbolically and then we're challenged with how to interpret the symbols and understand the pattern of 3 plus 1, all the other different things that are going on. And finally, at the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets booted out of the Beit Midrash. At least he doesn't get to vote. And his response, as we hear, 100 years later, Eliyahu says, God is very happy and says, Nitzchuni Banai. But what happens next? Oto hayom, heviu kol taharot shetiyah Rabbi Eliezer usafum ba'esh. They took all of the things that Rabbi Eliezer declared to be tahor, based on his rulings that they disagreed with, and they publicly burned them. Now, what does burning mean? Burning means that they regarded them as 100% tameh. If you have truma, you're not allowed to destroy it. You have to eat it. If it's tame, you have to destroy it. And the only thing in the middle is what we call tluya, which is if we don't know if it's tame, we bury it. But burning it is a statement that it is actually tame, without a question. So they made this public demonstration of rejecting Rabbi Eliezer's rulings. V'nimnu alav uvarchuhu. They took a vote. And what does it, barchuhu, mean?
Cursed him.
Right, exactly. It's a euphemism. They cursed him, which means they threw him in cherem. Right? Which means he had two choices. Remain that way, or come and ask Mechila for the fact that he wasn't accepting the majority's opinion, and to be accepted back. I think they knew that wasn't going to happen. Somebody's got to let him know.
Can I ask you a question?
How do you tell him? Yeah?
Assuming he has the same training as everybody else, why is he not accepting?
What? Why? His arguments, he's outvoted.
But he's aware of all these arguments that they're giving back to him.
And he feels differently. Why do we have any machloka? The question is not why even a whole. The question is, at the end of the process, when the Beit Din takes a vote, you got to accept the majority. Otherwise, you're a Zaken Mamre.
But he knows that too.
I know, but he's got a different position. His position, like I said last week, his position is that halacha is ultimately about Ritzon Hashem. I know Ritzon Hashem. I get it. And Haraya, the tree flies in the stream and everything else. And therefore, you guys are wrong, and you guys are going to destroy Torah. Trees are going to uprooted streams. The walls of Beit Midrash will fall in, which means Torah is going to be destroyed. That's a position.
Why did someone have to go tell him? Like,
how do we tell him he's in cherem? He's at home. He's at home in Lod. Right? How's he going to know that he's got it? The ball's in his court. Who's going
to
tell him?
No one's going to talk to him. That's how he's going to know.
So he'll know at some later point when he comes to Beit Midrash and they all walk away, but they want to let him know right now. When you got a good question. But they want to let him know right now. Give him a chance to do tshuva.
Doesn't he also know that by not accepting it, he's being put in prison?
So that's what Jason's asking. But this is probably something new that's happening here. See, the din of Zaken Mamre applies when you have Beit Din HaGadol. Right? So Beit Din HaGadol was sitting in Lishkat HaGazit, and they take a vote, and the vote is 40-31, or 70-1. That's totally fine. But if the one guy goes back to Lod or Bnei Brak, wherever his town is, and says the halacha is, like I say, that he's Zaken Mamre, he's Chayav Mita. Now, we don't have any of those mechanisms formally anymore. Not the Chayav Mita, and not the Zaken Mamre, and not the Beit Din HaGadol, but they're applying it here.
Wait, Zaken Mamre is in the Torah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Parshat Shoftim, sure. Amar Lam Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva said, Ani Elech. I'll go and tell him. Rabbi Akiva, remember, is a student of Rabbi Eliezer. Shema yelech adam sheino hagun viodiyof. Somebody goes and doesn't know how to tell him. Nimtzam machrivet kol olam kulo. He'll end up destroying the world. Now, that sounds kind of hyperbolic, but as you see from here, it's not. If somebody goes and tells him who doesn't know how to tell him, it could be very destructive. Right? As we know, how gentle, how careful you have to be when giving somebody bad news. Right? So, ma'asar biki, what do you do? Lavash chorim. First thing is he put on black clothes. The black clothes, unlike the way that we see it today, black clothes are a sign of mourning. Right? He covered himself in a black cover. He came into Rabbi Eliezer's house, sat 4 amot away, which is, by the way, what you got to do when somebody's in a cherem. Not allowed to be within their dalet amot. Amar lo Rabbi Eliezer. He said, Akiva, ma yom miyomayim. Why is today different than other days? Meaning, why are you behaving differently? You're dressed weird and you're sitting far away from me. Amalo Rebbe kum dumeli shechaverim dilem mimcha. It seems to me that the rest of the chaverim are avoiding you. This is the gentle way in which he says you're in cherem. He doesn't say you're in cherem. He says to me, it seems to me that the chaverim are avoiding you. So now what happened? Afu karab gadav chalatz min alav. So Rebbe Elazar did exactly what you have to do when you're in cherem. Which means, by the way, he accepted their ruling about the cherem. He took off his shoes and he tore his clothes. By the way, somebody who was benidui. If you remember from the third parak of Moed Katan, there are three who are kind of parallel, an Avel, a Menuda, and a Metzora. Tearing the clothes, and having the head covered, taking off the shoes. A lot of these things are similar. And that's what he did. Mishmat v'yashav v'gavya karka. He slipped off the bed and sat on the ground like an Avel. Zalgu enav d'maot. And this is when the trouble really starts. He starts crying. Now remember, he starts crying, takes us back to the beginning of the sugya. So again, everybody ends the sugya on the high note. Itzchuni banai, that's great. They don't read further. And again, there's good reasons not to, but in the larger context, even to ask the question, why is Tana Rosh Halacha in Bab Metziah? But larger is, what's the point of the story? The point of the story is a lot of points, but it's not just the one we made last week about the switching, the shifting of Torah legislation from the prophetic tradition to the reasoned argumentation. There's also something bigger going on. Lakah olam shlish b'zeitim, shlish b'chitim, shlish b'sorim. So evidently it means that a third of all of these crops got blighted as a result of Rabbi Eliezer's tears. Now you understand what Rabbi Akiva said, if the wrong person tells her, it could destroy the whole world. Now what's going on? Rabbi Eliezer is crying. As a result of that, the world is suffering. It sounds like God's punishing the world. Imagine that. A woman is kneading dough, and while it's in her hands, suddenly the dough goes bad. Or suddenly pops up, you know, like...
You mean instead of the
333? No, also, af. So Tana, af gadol haya, that was a very, very big day. What happened? Shebechol makom shatan bo'inav, Rabbi Eliezer nisraf. Now that's a little odd, because Rabbi Eliezer is sitting on the ground. So evidently there's an alternate version, or else at some point he got up and walked around, and everywhere he looked was the famous rabbi stare. Everywhere he looked, we got burned up. You know the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. But with Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and the story that when he came out of the cave, he looked and, you know, guys got burned up, a pile of bones, the sense was that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was on this intense spiritual level that it was just like human fire. Here, Rabbi Eliezer has not been elevated to a great level. Rabbi Eliezer has been the victim, if you will, of Ona'ah, in a sense. Even though, by the way, everything they've been doing is by the book. And he's crying. And suddenly his tears have this power that God is punishing as a result.
But this is the first time that you have this type of story with the Baal Kol and everything.
What?
This is the first time that you have this type of argument with one rabbi versus the rest in terms of the Baal Kol.
This is the only place we have that sort of thing. The Afra Magamliel Hayabab is Fina. Now Magamliel, by the way, curiously, is absent from the whole story. And here he comes in, and he comes in big. Who is Rabban Gamliel? Rabban Gamliel is the head of the Sanhedrin. Rabban Gamliel was not present, evidently, at the big scene with the Olba Shemaimhi, because the Rabbi Yeshua wouldn't have been the one to stand up and make the stand. Rabban Gamliel.
He was on a trip.
Where was Rabban Gamliel typically traveling to? To Rome, to plead the case. And therefore, we find a lot of stories of Rabban Gamliel on a boat. Some of the stories of Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Akiva on a boat together, the whole thing with the Masorot and everything. When Gamliel was on a boat, Amar alav nachshol letavo, a huge wave came and threatened to destroy the boat and to drown him. Amar kim dumeli she'ein ze'al yishvil Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkanus. He said, you know what, it must be because of what they did to Rabbi Eliezer. Evidently he knew about it. And he said, you know what, God's really angry about this, and this must be because of him, and I got to talk God down, so watch what he does. Amar al raglav yamar. Amar al raglav, by the way, we saw earlier in the sugya, which was Rabbi Yeshua amar al raglav, lo b'shamayim hi. Right? Here, Amar al raglav v'amar, by the way, who's he talking to?
God.
L'bashamayim. Okay. Rimono sholam, galu yodu l'fanacha sholoch podi asiti. You should know I did not do this. Do what? So evidently it means Rabbi Gamliel was the one who okayed the cherem. He wasn't there that day, but evidently afterwards he okayed the cherem. I didn't do it for me, my kavod. L'och vod beit abba asiti. I didn't do it for the Gamliel family, right, for the patriarch family. Elich vodcha. Shelo yabu machloket b'Yisrael. I did it to avoid machloket. We can't have machloket. We have to have one position, and the position is based on the majority of the Beit Din. This, by the way, is the driving force behind the most famous Rabbi Yeshua Megamliel story, which is when Megamliel ordered Rabbi Yeshua to come to him on the day that in Rabbi Yeshua's calendar was Yom Kippur, right? Where they had the machloket about the Eidim. And Rabbi Yeshua was right, and it really was Yom Kippur. But everybody, Rabbi Shua, went to take advice with Rabbi Dursa and Rabbi Kiva. All said, you know what? Once the head of the Beit Din makes a decision, that's it. And we've got to abide by it. And that's Rabbi Gamliel's position here. I did it to make sure we wouldn't have machloket be Israel. We can't have a loose cannon, no matter if he's the sharpest cannon in the bunch. We can't have a loose cannon. Nachayami Zapo. What happened? The sea settled. The sea settled. Okay. Now back at home, back in Lod. Ima Shalom. Ima Shalom is a really interesting character. Ima Shalom, you know, Abba is a popular title. it's a title given the number of Chachamim, Abba Shaul, Abba Chalafta, right? Abba is a title. The church fathers used that title earlier, which is why father and padre became popular, right? And why a monastery is often called an abbey. It's from Abba, right? But they also had this title for women. Some of the women are known as Ima. So Ima Shalom was Rabbi Gamliel's sister. Remember the story about Ima Shalom, Rabbi Gamliel coming to the magistrate and trying to expose him as a fraud because he'd take bribery? It was when Rabbi Gamliel died, Rabbi Gamliel and his sister came to the magistrate, and he and she said, "I want to split even." He said, "No, in our Torah it says the only the boys get Yerusha." And in the meantime, she brought him a bribe. Yeah, the lamp, right? The bribe. And then he said, "Oh no!" But now's the new law, and everything you inherit equally. And then Gamliel met with him privately, and he brought him a donkey. And he said, "You know what? Look, at the end of the law, it says I have." And he quotes Matthew. It's really funny. And then she says, "Let your wisdom shine. Let your light shine forth like a lamp." And then Gamliel says, "My donkey came and kicked over your lamp." It's a great story. And, you know, you kind of have to know Shabbos and Matthew to understand both sides of it. But Rabbi Shalom was one of the heroines in that story. Devitu Rabbi Lazar Achter Rabbi Gamliel Havi. She was married to Rabbi Eliezer, and she was Rabbi Gamliel's sister. She's right in the middle of the crosshairs of this one. What happened? Mehahu ma'aseva elach. From the time he was torn in Cherem, lo havi shavkel Rabbi Lazar lemei palapeh. She wouldn't let him say tachanu. By the way, saying tachanu doesn't mean this. Saying tachanu means falling on the ground. Nefilat apayim, literally, meaning with your face on the ground and begging God. She wouldn't let him say tachanun. Why? Because the notion was that if a great man says tachanun, whatever he asked for is going to happen. And she knew that he was after her brother. Hahu yoma reish yarchahave. There was one day, it was Rosh Chodesh. V'ichlava bin malach chaser. She got confused because she thought it was a Chodesh chaser. And so today wasn't Rosh Chodesh anymore. It really was Malay. 2 days Rosh Chodesh. She forgot it was Rosh Chodesh, right? The other version is that an ani came and knocked on the door while he was davening. By the way, Rabbi Lazar had a daven at home.
Right.
By the way, Rabbi Lazar probably didn't daven in shul anyways, because Rabbi Lazar was of the position that kol haoseh tefilato keva in tefilato tachanunim. Maybe Rabbi Lazar was of the position that we don't have this formalized public prayer 3 times a day. That's a lot of discussion about that in the Mishnah and Brachot. But in any case, he wasn't davening in shul anymore, if he ever was, because they wouldn't let him in. So he was at home, and she just wouldn't let him say tachanun. I guess every time he finished Shmoneh Esrei, she would ask him to take out the guy. I don't know, she would do something. One day, she either thought it was Rosh Chodesh, she wasn't paying attention, or else an oni came right at that moment, knocked on the door. Afika le'rifta, she brought out some bread to the oni. Ashkach did not fall on pay. As soon as she came in the room, she saw her Lozer and her husband on the floor. Nefilat
tapayim. He'd been waiting all that.
Amra le kum. She said, "Get up, katlit lachi. You must have killed my brother." Right? Adahachi nafak shipur and beitir Gamliel deshachiv. Just at that moment, the shofar was sounded. The announcement was made, and Gamliel had passed away. And we have to assume Gamliel was kind of, you know, not well, because you know. But in any case, the notion is Rabbi Eliezer's prayer killed Gamliel. This is not a happy end. It's not, and his prayers were answered, and you know, suddenly at the last minute, you know, then uncle died and left him in Yerusha, and he didn't have to leave the house. Amarla menayadat. So Rabbi Lazar says to his wife, "How would you know that? Not how would you know, like how'd you catch me, but why would you think that? You know, how did you know that? Knowing Rabbi Lazar died. Like kachum gan beit avi abba. I have a tradition from my family. Dainu, from the family of Gamliel, the patriarch family. Kol hasharim ninalim chutz misharei ona'a. All of the gates are closed except for the gates of Ona'ah. Meaning that if you were the victim of Ona'ah and you're praying, then your prayers are going to be answered. And if you're that angry at Megamliel, ultimately, and as evidenced by this agricultural destruction that went on and everything else, evidently God really listens to these tefillot, and you know, God really acts based on that.
Can you explain how closing means... I would have thought they're open. If they're gates of forgiveness, then they're all open. But it says they're closed.
No, kol hasharim nin alu chutz misharei ona'ah. Right? That means all gates, meaning the gate of tefillah when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed was closed. You can't get your tefillot through anymore. Right? You can't get your bakashot through anymore. But your dema'ot get through. And if and
it's
if
the victim of deceit,
yeah.
who can open up the gate to get
right,
justice.
Exactly. So somebody cries out because they've been victimized, and oh no, their cries break through that gate.
Why?
It's not closed for them. So now, what we have to take a look at the whole sugya, the whole piece. And if you look at the back page, you'll see that I kind of sketched it out. The question I asked at the beginning was that whole potpourri, the miscellany of statements, really is giving us all the information we need to understand the main point. In other words, you could read the sugya in a linear fashion and say it starts out with a bunch of statements, and then it's to illustrate one of the statements, here's a story, and here's the end of the story. Or you could say that really what they want to do is to teach you a lesson. And the lesson is how sensitive you have to be to people's feelings. The story is there in order to illustrate the lesson, but the lesson's at the end when the result of the story happens, when there's an agricultural disaster, and ultimately when God almost drowns the great leader at sea, which of course brings up all the Yonah associations very easily. Right? Here's a man on a mission from God, and here's a man running away from God. Right, but you know, and then ultimately he dies because the man who's in pain snuck in an extra prayer, a few extra tears. So then you have to look and backtrack it and say, maybe the statements at the beginning are there in order to set up the end. So what's the setup? The statements at the beginning are really of three different flavors. That A, ona'ah, is first of all, establishes that there's such a prohibition called ona'ah. So we have in the first statement. Then that ona'ah is on a sliding scale, meaning ona'ah is measured by the victim. Ona'ah, unlike onat mamon, which is measured by an exact thing of 1/6, if I sell you a $100 item for $102, that's not ona'ah. If I send you a $100 item for $120, that's ona'ah. There's a shear.
What's the definition of ona'ah?
Like I said, the price gouging, you will. But Onat Dvarim is not standardized. Onat Dvarim, we get that message here, is very much dependent on the individual. And that's why I say, hey, Adam's
like... He accepts the
right.
Criticism.
So you have, the man says, if a man insults his wife, it destroys him. Rabbi Eliezer evidently was destroyed by what happened here. And the fact that he was right or wrong isn't the issue. A man can be very upset with his wife about something. But if you upset, if your response to her is in such a way that evokes tears, then you went too far. And it doesn't matter how right you are, it's not so much the what, it's the how. Right? A critical thing, I think we all understand that. And so Rabbi Eliezer, evidently, the way that they did this, even though they might have been right on paper, and Rabbi Gamliel proves he's right by saying to the wave, I didn't do it, l'chvod me, l'chvod my family, I did it l'chvodcha, and the wave subsided. So he was right. But being right isn't good enough. You got to do it right. You got to be good besides being right. And it didn't work. And as a result, Rabbi Eliezer, who of course ends up dying tragically in Cherem, but Rabbi Eliezer's, this whole thing leads to all sorts of other tragedies. So then you take a look at the statements in the beginning and you just realize the statements in the beginning are of an interweave of relations between individuals, a relationship between a man and his wife, and how powerful a wife's influence can be, and see how the wife kept an eagle eye on her husband and making sure that he didn't do the wrong thing, right? And keep him, even though he was victimized, keeping him from expressing all of his anger and all of his upsetness and sadness at one time, right? All of these statements are like a setup. The story, the most famous part of this is actually the least significant piece. The Tanur Shel Achnoi is there to bring us to the end of the story, which is the important part, as evidenced by two things. By the beginning of the whole piece, which is about ona'ah, and by the context of this, which is in Bab Metzia, sugya of ona'ah. If this was about legislation, and this is about not listening to a bat call, what masachet would it be in? Be in Sanhedrin, might be in Horayot. Doesn't belong in Bab Metzia. It's in Bab Metzia because of ona'ah. And the story of Tanur Shel Achnoi is really just the launching pad to get us to the real story of the death of Rabbi Gamliel, and the tears of Rabbi Eliezer. And the, all the memorot at the beginning are there to set us up for that story. So now looking back, one last word is that agadot in Chazal, agadot in the Talmud, are anchored in the halacha. They start with the halacha. So the halacha here is onat tvarim. You may say there's onat tvarim. Onat tvarim can't really be quantified, But I think, by the way, just before this, you have the famous statement that a person should prefer to throw themselves into a fiery furnace rather than embarrass somebody, from Tamar. All those things about busha and shaming somebody. And that's all there. And so the context is onah. Subsequently, the agadot are these little agadic statements and observations based on psukim or not based on psukim about how powerful onah is and how onah is a sliding scale and about the impact of a wife on a man's life. And you're wondering, like, what's going on? It's like out of nowhere. And then you hear the story of Tanur Shalachnai, which has nothing to do with any of it until you get to the end, when it all comes together with the relationship between Ima Shalom and Rabbi Eliezer, between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim, and between Beliezer's tears and the impact on it, first on the world, then on everything he burns down, and ultimately Rabbi Gamliel, who is the victim of his own position, if you will.
What's the definition?